Daniel Jose Older. At 11:30, it's Words and Pictures, conversations with pioneering animators and comics artists. KBOO Community Radio is included in this year's Willamette Week Give Guide. Support KBOO in Give Guide today, and you'll be eligible for a Music Lover's Platinum Access Pass. You could win a Tender Loving Empire vinyl package and weekend passes to Treefort Music Fest, Sisters Folk Festival, McMenamin's Sabretooth Fest, Oregon Jamboree, Hair Fest, and two tickets to the select show of your choice at the Portland Jazz Festival. The Give Guide is an easy, secure way to make a gift to KBOO. Every gift is appreciated, and the Give Guide processes amounts starting at $10 online through an easy-to-use, secure platform. So go to kboo.fm/give for more information and to donate to your community radio station. And thank you. It's 9 o'clock.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available by calling the station at 503-231-8032. Meetings will be held at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue in Portland. The events committee meets the third Monday of every month at 5 o'clock p.m.
This is Press Watch, a weekly counter-propaganda and left opinion program here on your people's supported radio station, KBOO, Portland. I'm Teresa Mitchell. Join me for a brief peek behind the video veil of Monopoly media manipulation and an examination of the news you're not supposed to know. I have a lot of news to cover under the rubric News You're Not Supposed to Know. News that gets kind of drowned out. And I would like to invite your calls as well, because I would like to take the KBOO audience temperature on a number of things. But first, let me give you some news from Radio Havana, Cuba. The Inter-American Commission on Human Rights has called for an international investigation into human rights abuses in Bolivia following the disputed October presidential election that sparked weeks of violence. Evo Morales resigned as president on November 10th amid pressure after an audit by the OAS, which found widespread electoral irregularities. Morales maintains he was the victim of a coup. Weeks of unrest followed Morales' resignation, with security forces and protesters clashing in several cities as blockades went up that cut off major supplies of food and fuel. Now, it's interesting to me to read that from Radio Havana, because that, I imagine, just by way of summary, they include some of OAS talking points, the U.S. talking points, so to speak. Of course, it was the electoral irregularities were not of a nature that would exceed U.S. electoral irregularities, as you will recall. Polls were closed. Votes were flipped. The recount was shut down. And in fact, the president that we have now was elected with a minority of the votes that were allowed to be cast, even after all that. Those are some substantial electoral irregularities, especially since we have a monster in office who did not win the majority. So I don't want that phrase to be taken seriously. There was no substantial electoral irregularities in Bolivia. That's not what it was about. What it was about was overthrowing popular rule, overthrowing the rule of Bolivian indigenous, the hegemony of the indigenous, which had formed under that government. Returning to the text, at least 36 people have been killed in post-election violence, according to the report. On November 15th, 9 people were killed in the town of Sacaba after police and military attempted to stop a group of pro-Morales coca growers and farmers from marching to the city of Cochabamba. 4 days later, 9 others were killed in the El Alto neighborhood of Sancata, just outside the capital city of La Paz, during a police and military operation to clear a blockade of a fuel plant. Both events can be categorized as massacres, the report said. Several people were also killed in Pedregal to the south of La Paz. So there's more on that. You can find it at Radio Havana, Cuba. Radio HC dot K, excuse me, radiohc.cu/EN if you want it in English. Also from Radio Havana, the Yemeni Minister of Public Health and Population has warned about the catastrophic toll that the ongoing Saudi-led military onslaught and blockade has taken, stating that it is estimated that 1,000 children die in the crisis-hit and impoverished Arab country on a daily basis. Just want to read that part again. 1,000 children die in Yemen on a daily basis. 1,000 children a day. And this is the U.S.-supported ally, Saudi Arabia, attacking, using U.S. bombs and F-16s. Quoting Taha al-Matawakkil, we are facing a massacre being carried out by the coalition of aggression against Yemeni children, where at least 1,000 children die every day. Some 6,000 women have lost their lives as a result of complications, either during pregnancy or childbirth. End quote. Since the onset of the Saudi-led war in Yemen in 2015, more than 3,600 Yemeni children have been killed and 800 others paralyzed. Taha al-Matawakkil called for the opening of a humanitarian medical air bridge for Yemeni civilians who are suffering from conditions that cannot be treated inside the war-battered country. Matawakkil further noted that 93% of medical equipment and devices in Yemen are either out of service or have exceeded their expected useful lifespans. He highlighted that his ministry, at the beginning of the current year, appealed to international humanitarian organizations to provide it with necessary equipment, medicines, and medical personnel, but only 19% of the requests fulfilled so far. So the gist of that article, the U.S.-supported Saudi massacre, continues to go on, and we wonder why they hate us. On the ICE front, a teen migrant from Guatemala has died from the flu while inside a U.S. Border Patrol cell. And you can find the video of watching the poor young man die. I won't even say young man, that's a kid. Watch the kid die on video on YouTube. Because that's what we're about. ICE and CBP are secretly tracking us using stingrays, according to the ACLU. Stingrays, well, I'll go to the article. ICE and Customs Border Protection are using incredibly invasive surveillance technology as part of their continued efforts to target and tear apart communities across the country. They're doing so in near total secrecy and without any public accountability. The ACLU has been asking ICE and CBP for basic information about this program for years. And they write, now we're asking a federal court to intervene. In October 2019, Univision reported that an ICE deportation officer used a stingray, a surveillance device that secretly mimics a cell phone tower, to track down an immigrant suspected of unlawful reentry into the country. Little is publicly known about the use of stingrays in ICE and CBP immigration enforcement operations, but we know they've used the technology repeatedly. Stingrays, known as cell site simulators, track and locate cell phones and the people using them. Pinging away as they are carted around in unmarked vehicles by law enforcement agencies, these devices ensnare not only the suspect's cell phone, but innocent bystanders' phones as well. And I'm going to adjust my microphone just for a moment here, if you'll bear with me. Adjust to my condition. And I want to talk about stingrays. This applies here. When you see one of the larger drones going overhead, there's every chance when you're at an anti-ICE demonstration that your cell phone has been hijacked. The way it works is that a signal is put out to your phone that mimics the cell phone tower. So you think you're talking on your cell phone, or you think you're texting using the cell network, and that you have whatever protections, and I suppose those protections are thin, because you're using that commercial network. Well, you're not. First, it's going through the Stingray. This can be mounted in a van. It can be mounted in the ICE building. And these things are used continually, which means that they monitor every single thing that you do without a warrant. This is the Trump era, and his darlings at ICE and CBP don't have to worry about obeying the law. They just watch your phones. And you have to be aware of that. If you are planning something that you don't want them to have advanced knowledge of, then you can't use open signaling on a cell phone. You can't talk about it on a cell phone because of the stingers. So I just thought I'd let you know that's how that works. This is Press Watch, news you're not supposed to know. And I've been going over the headlines. Of course, right now, we're also in context of two major historical events. One is the impeachment of President Donald Trump, and the other is the British elections, in which they will decide to go either with Corbyn — this is Corbyn's biggest chance in the Labour Party — or with Boris Johnson and the Tories. And if you pull up the available corporate media, then you will find the demands and the urgings, maybe 6-1 for the Tories, because Tories are pro-corporate to a greater degree than Labour. And so corporations, the major newspapers, news agencies in Britain and around the world are very much foursquare behind the Tories. And that is happening as we speak. So if I get a chance, I may see what the latest is on that. And we can have a discussion about that if you like. Now, on these topics that I brought up and that I am going to bring up, you're invited to weigh in with your opinion, your comments, your questions. Number to call for that is 503-231-8187, 503-231-8187. My name is Teresa Mitchell, and this show is called Press Watch on your people-supported free radio station, KBOO Portland, a true gem, something that is a rare thing, as I found traveling across the country, a rare thing to be able to hear a thriving people's radio station. And what a thrill it was when I managed to tune one in. You know what I mostly tuned in when I went down to the lower parts of the frequencies searching for such things was Catholic radio. And Catholic radio would be telling people basically how to obey, and women how to think of themselves in that Catholic constricted sort of way. But there are many, many topics that we need to discuss. Smoke in Sydney, Australia from wildfires caused an air particle count of 2,552. And if that sounds high, well, it really, really is. It's 12 times worse than what is considered hazardous. That is vastly worse than the choking smoke levels we experienced here in Portland just a couple of years ago. Fire alarms are going off inside buildings. 90 fires are burning. 700 houses have gone up in smoke, and millions of acres are scorched. Hospital admissions are up 10%. Their economy is also in the hands of oligarchs, and they are fast-tracking the opening of a new coal mine, even as everyone chokes from climate change. In Siberia, towns are falling into rivers as the permafrost melts, exposing woolly mammoths frozen for tens of thousands of years, off-gassing carbon dioxide and methane, turning firm ground into dangerous rolling hummocks and swamp, releasing long-dormant diseases. Sometimes the methane explodes, leaving vast craters. Arctic ice is giving up the ghost. Glaciers in Greenland and Antarctica are beginning to slide into the sea. Polar bears are trapped by the dozens in a Russian town, unable to cross ice to their feeding grounds. The super-rich around the world are buying up filter-equipped homes and bunkers so that they can watch in comfort as the rest of us choke and die. Aside from that, things are great. How are you? Number to call, 503-231-8187, 503-231-8187. Are you ready to fight back? What would that look like? What is moral when it comes to a fight back against your own extinction and the extinction of everyone you love, you hold dear, and your progeny into infinity? What is moral when it comes to a fight against extinction in a system of oligarchy where you do not have effective power, where there will be no plebiscite on what to do on the climate extinction emergency? Is it moral? Is it moral to, say, create squads of high-caliber rifle teams and go out and knock out the refinery towers in the seven major refineries in the U.S., would that be moral or is that immoral? It's time to ask these questions. Number to call, 503-231-8187. And that sort of thing is difficult for one thing. I mean, aside from a moral question, at minimum wage in Portland, you can work 40 hours a week and still not take home enough to even pay for an average two-bedroom apartment. And I know a lot of you listening to me right now have an advanced degree. You are amazing academicians. You have proven your worth, and you're still getting something that is based on minimum wage. And that's true of the nonprofit sector as well, and KBOO doesn't have money to pay big wages either. That's significant because so many jobs are based on minimum scale, and so many jobs are impermanent. And I'm talking about working all day, every workday, and still being short rent before you can feed your kids, before you can pay 1 cent into food, much less utilities and gasoline and clothing and medicine and all of the other things necessary to survive. So you take two jobs, so you take three jobs, so you think you're getting ahead, you're exhausted every day, and what happens? You get sick. Something happens. Some bill. A family member needs extra care. You can't work one of those jobs. You can't work two of those jobs. You have to start over. You get behind. You get in debt. You end up on the sidewalk. That cruelty is common fare now. That doesn't make it any less cruel. It's insane. That disparity between rent and pay is driving us onto the street where we live in cars and tents and RVs and dodge neighbors and cops and crazies and extremes of weather. And even if we manage to avoid that for a while, it's always looming, always a threat. Our constant struggle for basic needs has a political effect, too. It keeps us desperately busy, desperately tired, leery of any brush with the law as one might expect in, say, a demonstration to demand a living wage and housing for all. Funny how that works. And the bus system isn't making it any better. I got a note from Joe saying, please talk about fareless mass transit and the local push to abolish fares on TriMet. This combined TriMet is the local... is the municipal bus service in Portland, Oregon. This combined with dedicated mass transit infrastructure like bus lanes and are the time is now imperative climate change puts on us. Speak against classist fear-mongering against a fareless TriMet becoming a day shelter like the libraries. Okay, I will do that. That has happened. And if you don't think ahead, in Austin, Texas, fares went fareless after they successfully introduced a sales tax, which covered financially every aspect of the transit system there. This is years and years ago. And in Austin, it becomes unbearably hot. It becomes killing hot in the summer. And people who were living on the streets simply got on the buses because they could. And the buses rolled around with people who were in various stages of the desperation that drives you onto the streets. And some of them were smelly and pukey and nuts and, a minority, of course. But that's enough to make it unendurable, and people couldn't get on the bus, but that was easily solved. Not the way Austin solved it. Austin solved it by putting in a nominal fare. Actually, TriMet already has a policy that you can only ride the bus so much. So if you try to do that, even with a fareless system, you would end up not where you wanted to be. You can't just ride around endlessly on a TriMet bus. So you don't have to worry about that. And I agree that we should fund the system differently. Fares are only a minority portion of income for TriMet, and those buses should be free, and that would make a huge difference. The bus system needs to be expanded so that we can get around all day and all night, and that will increase the productivity, actually, the economic productivity here, to have all day and all night free fare service. We need it now, and don't worry about that that idea that it's going to become marked entirely by squalor. Just a couple of tweaks takes care of that, and you don't have to worry about it. So I hope that does the job there, Joe, and I hope that fits in on what I was talking about. But I was talking about just how hard it is to make it, but I want you to understand that if you fall into that category, you are nearly half the population. You that fall into that category that I just described, where you're right on the edge of things, are half of the U.S. population, and you are made to believe that you have failed and that you're a minority and that you have something to apologize for. No, you're hard workers. You're available for work. You want to support your kids. You want to get ahead in life. And getting ahead in life is not a bad thing in this context. It's just you need the security to do what you need to do in life, to live without being in constant thrall to one low-paying employer after another. And the fact is, let me turn to the corporate press on this, because this is not commie news here that I'm giving you. This is CBS News. They write, almost half of U.S. workers between ages 18 and 64 are employed in low-wage jobs. That's according to the Brookings Institution. Now, don't let that wash over you. Let that stick. It's true. It's the Brookings Institution. It's CBS News. This is not some, you know, wacko website. This is not speculation. Half of U.S. workers between 18 and 64 are employed in low-wage jobs. Now, think about that. When you get told that the economy is doing okay, that's roaring, it'd probably get better, doing all right, that the unemployment rate is X%, that's a lie. It's meant to keep you in line. The employment rates that are used from the Bureau of Labor Statistics have been jiggered a long time ago. They were changed. The main one that's presented to the press was changed. And the Army was added in, and everyone who isn't currently applying for work was taken out to give a false number. These are false numbers. The truth is half of us are desperate. Half are poor. If you're on the edge of disaster, you're poor and you're working class. So let me frame it again. Half of the United States workforce is poor working class. Let me turn back to the CBS article. Low-wage jobs are pervasive, representing between one-third to two-thirds of all jobs in the country's almost 400 metro areas. Smaller cities in the South and West tend to have the highest share, like Las Cruces, New Mexico, and Jacksonville, North Carolina, where more than 6 in 10 workers are in low-wage work. Pardon me. America's unemployment rate is at a half-century low. But it also has a job quality problem that affects nearly half the population, with a study finding 44% of U.S. workers are employed in low-wage jobs that pay median annual wages of $18,000. Ouch. Contrary to popular opinion, these workers aren't teenagers or young adults just starting their career. That's according to Martha Ross and Nicole Bateman of the Brookings Institute's Metropolitan Policy Program, which conducted the analysis. Most of the 53 million Americans working in low-wage jobs are adults in their prime working years. That's you. That's you in the KBU audience, I know from experience. Between 25 to 54, median hourly wage is $10.22 an hour. That's above the federal minimum wage of $7.25, but well below what's considered the living wage for many regions. Now, ask any of those workers, ask any of you listening to me right now, this is one of the things that frustrates me, and I'm pointing at you right now. They'll tell you they're middle class. Not middle class. Americans think middle class is anyone with a job, three shirts, and a junk mobile. And working class is some, you know, I don't know what, some slob working on a golf cart with stained overalls. Not that I've got anything, not that there's anything wrong with working on a golf cart, but I'm just saying there's some stereotype in there. And the fact is, you're all working class. I'm working class, you're working class. If you depend on a check to survive, you're working class. Now, I'm one of the few, the proud, the lucky. I made it, even though my spine has all kinds of problems. I made it to retirement age, and I'm getting two pensions, which I paid forward. I'm taking the money that I earned over the span of my working life. And I'm still working class poor, but I've got steady income. Lucky me. And unusual. You're all working class, and there is almost no middle class anymore. If you define middle class as someone who isn't rich but could live on their savings for 3 years without getting another paycheck, that ain't you. And you have 10 rental properties that dad gave you out of college, you're not middle class either. You're rich. You don't have to work. Your net worth is over a million, and you're not the richest of the rich, but neither can you call yourself middle class. You do. You call yourself middle class. We need to be clear about class in the United States. We need to own who we are. We need to be humble, but we also need to have some pride in what we do. You're productive people. You're half the population that simply is not paid enough, not because of your worth, but because capitalism is predatory and unregulated in the United States. What do you think about that? The number to call is 503-231-8187, 503-231-8187. If you're listening to me online, then you can use that same expensive little snitch to give me a call, 503-231-8187. You know, people, it's like the closest we like to get to direct communication is texting these days, and back from that is emailing, using a Snapchat, using a TikTok, whatever, things that can be viewed at any time. And it's gotten, in this era, it's gotten to where a phone call seems intrusive. You get out of the habit of doing it. You know, it's like, oh, where's the phone icon on this thing? It's okay. Give me a call, 503-231-8187, and talk about what I'm talking about here. Now, there's something related to this I want to bring up. There's a man killed by Portland police recently over on 103rd Stark. Witnesses say he seemed confused. I want to present this partly from Emily Goodykrunz. I'll try that again. Emily Goodykrunz article in the Oregonian and Oregon Live, and partly with some backup information. So, Sunday, there was a fatal shooting of a man near Mall 205. It's the fifth fatal shooting for the Portland Police Department of 2019. It's the most since 2010. 9 years ago, when Portland police also shot and killed five people. So far, the agency has released few details about the timeline of events or circumstances surrounding the officer's use of lethal force against a man walking in traffic on Southeast 103rd Drive near Stark Street. On Monday, the Multnomah County Medical Examiner identified the man as Coben S. Hendrickson, a 51-year-old man who has experienced severe mental illness, according to court records. In 2014, Clackamas County Court sent Hendrickson to the Oregon State Hospital for trial fitness treatment after finding that he was mentally unfit to aid and assist in his own defense in a misdemeanor theft case, showing that Hendrickson suffered some form of severe mental illness at the time. The charges were eventually dismissed. Dispatch records and witness accounts helped pull the shooting into clearer focus, depicting a fatal encounter unfolding seconds after two officers' initial contact with Hendrickson. On Monday, police named Justin Raphael as the officer who fired the fatal shots. He has been with Portland Police for 7 years. Officer Daniel Leonard, an 11-year veteran with the agency, fired less lethal rounds. Both are on paid administrative leave while Portland Police conduct an internal review and the Multnomah County District Attorney investigates the shooting. This is from the Oregon Live, Oregonian. Police received a call at 1:40 p.m. Sunday reporting suspicious circumstances involving a weapon, according to their news release. I'm going to stop right there, because there are more details that came out about that. By the way, the number to call, 503-231-8187, because people are saying that he didn't have a weapon, but someone called and said he had a weapon. People, you call in, somebody is crazy and walking down the streets or something, and maybe you want immediate response. Maybe you shouldn't call the police for a start. Maybe there's some other way to deal with it. Because time and again, even times when people seem kind of crazy because actually they're on fire, they've been killed by police who've been called saying there's a crazy out-of-control person, and especially if this is a person of color. Think about it. Do you want to be complicit in someone's death? Is it that bad? Should you call the police? Think about that before you call the police. I had my car stolen some years ago. I didn't know who stole it, but I decided the first thing I wanted to do was go around the neighborhood, and, you know, it's an old car. I've always had old cars, and I knew it was likely that someone stole it and stashed it. So I just went around the neighborhood, found it, and drove it back. Now, if I had found it and called the police, someone could be dead. I don't want that on me. A car is not worth a life. What is worth a life? When you want to call the police? I would say, generally speaking, don't. Anyway, number to call, 503-231-8187. Sergeant, let me go back a little bit. Dispatch call recordings show that two callers reported that a man, presumably Hendrickson, was standing in the middle of the road near Southeast 103rd and Stark, pointing a knife at passing cars. Sergeant Kevin Allen said Monday he could not confirm whether Hendrickson was armed with a knife or other weapon. Portland Police police policy on use of force directs officers to avoid or minimize force used on people in a behavioral or mental health crisis and people with mental illnesses. Officers should direct those people to services where possible. Leonard and Raphael responded to the scene. Police said Leonard was armed with less lethal 40-millimeter launcher that shoots foam-tipped projectiles. Raphael carried a rifle, according to witness accounts and dispatch calls. And I want to talk about that information for a moment as well, and then I'll get to Jack in just a moment, who's called in. By the way, the number is 503-231-8187, and this is from the Firearm Blog. The projectile itself is a spongy blue round and feels like a tightly packed neoprene to the touch. In other words, like a heavy rubber ball. The round has the approximate range of a tennis court in length. At closer ranges, the round can be extremely lethal, as it is a 40-millimeter grenade fired from a rifled M203A2 barrel, after all. But just like paintball ammunition, its velocity drops dramatically, and beyond moderate ranges, it is both inaccurate and lost its power. So this is a heavy, rubbery projectile, and if you've seen those grenade launchers on the underneath of, mounted on the other side of assault rifles, that's what we're talking about. These are great big cartridges, a lot of force behind them, and it's, if you can imagine a major league baseball pitcher with a heavier, denser ball hurling it right into your chest. That would be about what, that's the idea with these things. So I'm going to go ahead and go to the first caller, 503-231-8187. Hi, you're on the air.
Yeah, it's a little bit recently, and I lived in Japan for some time. Police don't carry guns in Japan. Well, they didn't when I lived there anyway. Now, there's not a lot of guns in the society to begin with because the gun laws are pretty strict. But what I read was pointing a knife at traffic. That's the way I read it the first time I read this story.
That's what it says.
There's a lot of darn good knives in Japan, so knife attacks do happen. But Japanese police are trained to suppress. Suspects with jujitsu, and they're very good at it. It's being trained here too in some places, but it's not being taken up very much. And it's you can see training videos and even some live action stuff online.
Yeah, I'm actually familiar with that. You can't attack a Japanese policeman with a knife. You're going to end up on the floor with him on top of you and a sprained wrist.
That's right. You will be completely suppressed. Now the techniques, what they call Brazilian jiu-jitsu, it's a kind of a hybrid, but it's designed specifically for the use of the law enforcement officers. It's basically you smother the suspect and completely subdue them by locking up all limbs so they really can't fight. You know, and you don't fight them, you just smother them, and then you get help, and then you put the cuffs on, and then do the business. But I had this discussion with the Paul yesterday, and he wanted to say you can't it's the culture. The problem is the culture. You can't change the culture. Well, agreed. You know, if there was some cultural awareness in law enforcement that realized non-lethal methods are available, they can be applied, and we'd save a lot of avoid a lot of senseless shootings. Nevertheless, it should be out in the discussion that this is an option.
I quite agree. And the attitude that they have to open fire, that they're absolutely in danger and this sort of thing, is just something we've been conditioned to believe. And to me, as a 20-year veteran of municipal bus driving, it's really ridiculous. I mean, if I shot everyone that I ever saw with a knife or gun who was, you know, had a grumpy look on their face, there'd be a few dead people.
Yeah, so I don't know if you learned jiu-jitsu or what, but you probably learned how to talk people down off of a crazy high or something.
Yeah, no, I talk them down.
Yeah, so that should be the first level of engagement. But for some crazy reason, it may have to do with the fact that so many police come directly out of the military into law enforcement service, and there is quite a love of weaponry and ballistics and all that, and I understand also that, I mean, if you do jiu-jitsu the way you need to do it to really suppress someone, you have to have pretty close body contact with them, and I suppose a lot of policemen say, I don't want to touch that person, I'm just going to shoot him.
I think so. Yeah, and especially since we've hired so many people right out of Iraq combat, and when I look at people talking on YouTube about Iraq combat, a lot of them say we had throwdown weapons with us because when you make a mistake, you want to be sure that you can photograph an AK or even just a big knife or something so you can say I was in danger and therefore not get in trouble for someone that you just shot dead with your war rifle. And this seems to be the same attitude with police departments.
Yeah. Okay, so I thought I'd inject that, and thanks for taking my call.
Thanks for calling in. Number to call, 503-231-8187. Now, I'm continuing with this narrative about what happened with the killing of, let's see if I can find his name, Hendrickson. According to dispatch call recordings, the officers met at Southeast 106th and Southeast Cherry Blossom Drive before approaching Hendrickson just a few blocks from where he was blocking traffic. He's standing in the road. Witnesses told the Oregonian that two police vehicles drove up to the man in close succession about 6.5 minutes after the initial call to police. Officers appeared to make contact with Hendrickson, according to dispatch recordings. Recordings show that 13 seconds later, dispatch called for a medical response. An officer's voice can be heard saying, "Officers are okay. Suspect is down." And departing from the Oregonian's article, that's 13 seconds. Count them. 1 through 13. Man's dead. Robert Vervloot, 58. I'm sorry if I'm mispronouncing your name, Robert, was waiting for his drink at Starbucks when he witnessed police fatally shoot Hendrickson. Vervloot, a longtime Portland resident, had just finished shopping at a nearby Fred Meyer and had stopped to grab a hot eggnog drink on his way home. His girlfriend was waiting in their car, parked in the lot. It was about 1:40 p.m. That's when Vervloot heard the honking loud and piercing across from the coffee shop, the Oregonian writer writes. He saw a man standing in front of an 18-wheeler truck that was attempting to drive north on Southeast 103rd. The driver rolled down a window and said something to the man, who then walked slowly into the next lane of traffic towards Vervloot and Starbucks. The man was 2 to 3 car lengths from the intersection with Stark, Vervloot said. Vervloot watched as the man casually walked hands at his side across the street, ignoring the vehicles coming towards him. He didn't see the man carrying a weapon or knife, or see him acting aggressively toward the vehicles, he said. Vervloot said this man was walking. He didn't look threatening in any way, shape, or form. He was almost in a zombie-like state. There was no aggression, end quote. Another car, this time a smaller white car, screeched to a halt to avoid hitting Hendrickson. Vervloot said, quote, "Seconds after that, the first police car arrives," end quote. It rolled in with the flow of traffic. Traveling north on 103rd, a police SUV arrived from the same direction a few seconds later. The SUV caught Vervloot's attention. An officer opened the driver's side door, stood, and propped what looked like an AR-15-style rifle on the door. The man had made his way onto the sidewalk along the side of the Starbucks parking lot and was standing with his hands still at his sides, Vervloot said. The officer pointed his rifle in the man's direction and the direction of Starbucks. Vervloot said, quote, "My brain was drawing the bead line of where the bullet could travel if they missed," end quote. That's a good idea, I should think, because those assault-style rifle bullets, they don't stop when they hit somebody. They just keep going. The man walked zombie style toward the two cops, Vervloot said. Vervloot didn't hear any words exchanged between the officers and the man. He just heard himself yell, "No, this is not going to happen." But the officer with the rifle fired shots. Vervloot heard two, and the man fell. Vervloot couldn't see what, if any, weapons the other officer was holding. He did not see the other officer fire. It all happened in a matter of seconds, he said. Quoting Vervloot, "All I could see was that the officer get out of his all I could see was that officer get out of his vehicle, level his gun, and pull the trigger, bottom line," end quote. Sergeant Kevin Allen told the Oregonian that some officers do carry AR-15 rifles after they undergo extensive training and earn a certification. Speaking for myself, what I have read is that just about every cruiser has one mounted in the trunk. But returning to that text, he also said there is no set amount of time that officers should wait between firing less lethal and then lethal rounds, saying it is entirely situation dependent. The Oregonian found no specific procedure outlining appropriate escalation from firing less lethal to lethal rounds in the Portland Police Use of Force policy, but it directs officers to use the least amount of force necessary, reasonably calculated to maintain control. Now, in my mind, this comes in the context of the incident in, I believe it was Houston, which a UPS driver was taken hostage, and you could see on the overhead drone videotapes that the police approached the van in traffic once they had been shot at, and seemed to be mostly concerned with returning fire no matter what, and watched the poor UPS driver be pushed or knocked out of the vehicle on the passenger side as a pool of blood spread from his beating heart. He was slain, of course, because there was a hail of fire from several guns of police who looked like they were determined to make war on that truck no matter what. And I think that reveals a certain attitude. Who are they protecting? I don't think they're protecting anyone except their own fury in engaging in that sort of tactic. We've got a hostage. They knew that it wasn't the UPS driver, so they had to have known that shooting at that UPS truck was likely to hurt someone other than who they're shooting at. And I'm going to hazard a guess that at the moment they really didn't give a damn. Because what are the cops here for? When you report a theft, your bike gets stolen, your car gets stolen, do you find the police rush to your aid? I'll just leave that out there. So, on the Oregonian article, by the way, you can call in with your comments and questions, 503-231-8187. Verveloet spent the next few hours tucked away from public view on a TriMet bus, which police said serves as a warm place to hold witnesses at large crime scenes. An officer who stayed on the bus with witnesses told them not to discuss with each other what they'd seen, Verveloet said. Now I want to turn to comments on this that I find online from Cliff Gilley, J.D., quote, in the U.S., nobody is required by law to assist police in their investigations as long as you don't lie to them, act to hide evidence, or hinder the investigation through positive action. There's little to nothing that can be done about it. The most that will likely happen is to threaten you with obstruction of justice charge and possibly arrest you on those grounds, which would be thrown out rather quickly if you did not, in fact, do anything to affect their investigation, end quote. From robertslaw.org, quote, see Terry v. Ohio, the constitutional propriety of the detention will turn on four factors. First, the seriousness of the crime witnessed. Pardon me. Second, the nature of the information the witness can reasonably expect to provide. Third, the level of proof that the witness can provide. And fourth, whether there are less intrusive methods to obtain the same information. And it gives a number of citations after that and says, in considering these factors, the most serious the offense, the more likely the court will hold that the special needs seizure is constitutional. So I'm going to say I'm not a lawyer and don't even play one on the radio. But it seems to me that if you didn't see much and you can leave a phone number and an address with the cop, there's no reason to hold you on a bus for hours. Unless, of course, the cops would like to impress on you what their version of the story is. And that's what they do in grand jury proceedings, if and when it even goes to that in a situation like this. The grand jury process, as raw as it is turned on its head, and it becomes a Stockholm Syndrome-like situation, which you, the juror, or potential juror, are brought in and told the police and the prosecutors into the story endlessly so that you vote, you know, hoping to get free and hoping not to infuriate these people who hold you hostage, so that you vote with them and that no consequences fall on the cops. I want to say, if there is a way to use whiteness, it is to answer your jury summons and to be aware of jury nullification, i.e. your right to say no to a charge if there's something wrong with it, no matter what the judge instructs. It's your right. It is your right not to be intimidated by that sort of proceedings and to call for a trial for a cop if that is what is necessary. And it looks from the initial evidence like that sort of thing, like there needs to be a trial for this cop. 13 seconds later, he shot this guy? Come on. I am not sympathetic with this idea that he had a knife, therefore you get to blow him away. Not popping out of your cruiser at range, second cop there. No, like I said, I was a bus driver. People came up, my life was in danger from people like that over and over again over 20 years. Sometimes because they hated me for being trans, and but more often just because they're a freaking thug or drunk or flipping out on meth. And I did not seek to kill these people. Why would I? And here I am. I'm fine. So I don't believe this police stuff about how they absolutely have to blow people away with war rifles. It's nonsense, and it needs to stop, and it won't stop until we white people use our whiteness to get on these juries and then nullify trials when they are inappropriate, when people are obviously getting a harsh charge sentence for being a person of color, and use our whiteness to get on grand juries and just stick it out and demand and convince your fellow jurors that a trial needs to be held. Trial needs to be held. That's about all we've got against the cops right now, because the corporate media will always run with the official cop excuses. And indeed, this article in Oregon Live goes with... this is a good article. I don't want to criticize this article particularly, but this one, of course, quotes Chief Outlaw saying, "Police officers responded to a dynamic situation involving an armed suspect. This is still early in the investigation. We will work within the process to release as much information as we can without compromising any of the investigation," yada, yada. And everyone looks away. But this is the fifth killing this year, and there have been so many... Well, frankly, there have been so many murders. And right now, and speaking as a transgender person, I am aware that I also fall in the category of someone who can be blown away at any time with any cop, by any cop, and that cop will get away with it. There is no doubt about it. It's just up to them. They feel like blowing me away today, they can do it. And all of you listening to me who do not have such pale skin know that that applies to you as well. And that's unacceptable, I should think. Number to call, 503-231-8187. And I'll go to Rob on the air.
Good morning.
Good morning.
I appreciate you talking about this topic. I just wanted to share a story and then just something else to add to this mix here. But I'm a victim of police brutality. I was in Tucson, Arizona, and I was attacked by a police officer. He maced me in my car for speeding.
He maced you in your car? What
yeah,
the hell?
And so, and this is the funniest part of the story. I grabbed my cell phone, when he maced me, he started choking and coughing, and he had to like get out of the, you know, he had to like back up from my window.
Right, a little backlash there.
So I grabbed my cell phone and I called 911.
Ah.
And to this day, the wildest thing that I tell people about is when I called 911 and I said I just got maced by a police officer in my car.
Huh.
Without thinking, the dispatch goes, she goes, "Are you wearing your seatbelt?" Without even thinking. I just told 911 I got maced by a police officer in my car. She goes, "Are you seatbelted?" I go, "Yes, I am seatbelted." She knew how to take the call.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying, though? I mean, how many times have people called the police on the police? That's what came to my mind. I was like, oh, my God, this isn't her first time. She, you know.
That's really interesting. It's not her first rodeo. Are you seatbelted?
How many times have people called the police on the police, you know? And so when that happened, anyway, it was a huge fiasco. The police totally covered their tracks when Daniel Outlaw says that, oh, we're going to release as much information as we can. You know, we're basically allowing, you know, a conflict of interest to occur where it's the police to police themselves, which I find extremely ironic, but that's what happened with my case too. I filed a thing to the Internal Affairs Bureau office, and immediately, I don't know, after a week or so, they sent me a letter. They're like, "Oh, our officer didn't act out of, you know, whatever." And then I was trying to find an attorney, and this is where I found out my other thing, the other thing I'd like to bring up, which is attorneys that take cases against police officers. Like, we may know George Zimmerman, who was on, for the Trayvon Martin killing. And then I also believe Michael Brown and Eric Garner. I believe it was those three. They all had the same attorney. A lot of people don't know that, but that is because attorneys do not take cases against police in the same state that they live in. So I couldn't find an attorney that would help me with my case. And then when I did find an attorney who started telling me, because like when I was going left and right and they were just like, "Nope, we're not taking this case." And then I finally found one attorney who was like, "Oh, well, they're not taking your case because no attorney takes a case against a police officer." And then I was like, "Whoa." And I was like, "Yeah." And then on top of that, he goes, "Okay." And he's like, "Well, and I'll get some more information for you." You know, he was a really helpful attorney. But then I told him I had taken, the steps with the Internal Affairs Review, which is what you're told to do if you have a problem with the police department. You're told to go to the Internal Affairs. When I told him that, he laughed. He was like, "Oh, they just covered everything."
Have to get a lawyer, and I wouldn't say all lawyers, because I did find a lawyer right away, and I guess it takes some work, and it's worth any work, any promise. I know lawyers who have taken live macaws as payment, and just work any deal you can. If you get stopped by the cops and you have to face something like this, anything the attorney is worth the payment.
You mean, but I think you're talking about fighting the case, right?
Yeah.
That would be that would just be trying to get innocent. But I meant in terms of prosecuting a police officer for a killing or
yes,
to that degree.
I see what you mean. Well, that surely is much more difficult. Well, right. I also want to take this opportunity to say, if you witness something like this, please get out your cell phone as quickly as possible. Take pictures, take videos, because you particularly need to pay attention to the moment after the shots have been fired and the person who's been shot is on the ground. You need a photograph of that moment, that second. And also, I would like to inform anyone and everyone that this sort of thing happens at or near you. The buses have, I think, at least 6 color cameras with audio systems that can be subpoenaed, and they have to keep it, especially once they're notified that record is there. But if you're able to get out your cell phone and take that photograph, that can make a difference, because the cops will throw down a weapon in a case where they think maybe they acted too hastily, they shot by mistake, or they think they're going to get busted for it. That knife or that gun is going to appear after the initial. It could appear within seconds of the person getting thrown down. It's going to happen when those cops appear to, you know, as I say, secure the suspect. Or often as not, they'll go back to the trunk of their car and come back, and that's when they slip, you know, the object underneath them. So watch out for throwdown weapons.
Yeah, that's an excellent point. And you are completely I would definitely say learn some of the rights that you have, because it is completely legal to record a police officer.
Oh yeah.
Which is the first thing that they'll say is, you know, "You can't record this. You have to move." And that's completely not true. I'll say one other statement, which is, these police officers are killing machines. They are killers. They want to kill. That is what they're doing. That's what they're trained. That's what they've been trained to do. And it was, you know, I mean, on top of the Japanese jiu-jitsu, all the stuff that we were talking about, there was also there was an instance, I believe, in Germany or something, where somebody was charging police officers with a knife, and they shot him in the leg. You know, what a concept! Like, I'm not agreeing with police officers are shooting. You know, there's all these other tactics, but I mean, my God, you know, like, how is it that this cop has an AR-15, shoots to kill?
Yeah, well, I mean, I suppose that doesn't apply in every situation, but a lot of times it does. Someone's, you know, coming up towards you, they've got a knife, and you've got some weapon that's got 20 rounds in the clip. I think you've got a pretty good chance of hitting them in the thigh.
You don't have to kill them, yeah. Anyway, Teresa, thank you very much for everything. I'm gonna get off the air. Thank you for what you're doing.
Thanks for calling in. Number to call, 503-231-8187, 503-231-8187. And this is the society that we have put together. This is the way that our cops think, the way they exist now. And this is why I say that we need to start over. We need to pension off these guys and take them out of a police force and start over with something that is actually of, by, and for the people, as opposed to, well, right now, one of the words that gives it away for me is the way the word civilian is used. Often it's not in press discussions, press articles I see, the word civilian applied to everyone but police. Police are civilians. They're not military. They're not supposed to be against us. They're supposed to be among us. That's how far we are from a rational frame of thought. Police are supposed to be civilians. But got a couple of minutes left, so I'll go to the next caller, 503-231-8187. Hi, you're on the air.
Good morning, Teresa.
Hi, good morning.
Thank you very much for your intelligence. Yes, indeed. Posse comitatus is quite relevant in this particular case, considering he was using an assault rifle. One of the principles of firearms ownership is you make absolutely sure of your target and what's behind it. He should not be armed with an assault rifle via posse comitatus, but there are plenty of non-lethal ordinances. I'm quite familiar with logistics and various kinds of firearms and ordinances, and it's just absurd. How about we don't send somebody fresh from a war zone and give them a policing role? You are most correct, they are civilians, but they don't seem to act like it. And, I have a... that's about it,
I think. Well, that's a good point, I think.
It's really just absurd, the entire thing. 13 seconds, there's a vast array of non-lethal ordinances which could have been used. And, yeah, we're in a highly dangerous place. I've been researching totalitarian states on a daily basis for over 30 years. I have a paper you might be interested in reading. However, you only have a couple minutes left. I just wanted to make that point really clear.
Okay,
it is a highly dangerous position.
It's a good
point.
Thank
you for your efforts.
Thanks for calling in. Well, then I'll read from Wikipedia. The Posse Comitatus Act is a United States federal law signed on June 18th, 1878, in the wake, socially, of the war between the states. The purpose of the act, in concert with the Insurrection Act of 1807, is to limit the powers of the federal government in using federal military personnel to enforce domestic policies in the United States. So, and the point I believe the caller was making is that this violates the spirit of the Posse Comitatus Act because, you know, the person with the rifle may not have come in as a separate military unit with a separate military unit, but are the cops military when they've got war material going around with them? And as I said, I believe those AR-15s are in just about every cruiser trunk. They can pull those out anytime. And those rifle bullets travel at a supersonic rate. They are, I believe they're .223 caliber, but they are quite long. These are large, heavy bullets that will tear a hole in you the size of a teacup, and it's pretty ugly to have that for civilian law enforcement. As a matter of fact, I'd say it's not for civilian law enforcement by and large. It's for civilian intimidation. And cops have reported that in their trainings, they're told by trainers that in a situation where they have their gun out and they believe it's necessary to fire, it's best to make sure that it is a lethal encounter because that way they will not be confronted in court by the survivor of the bullet wound or wounds. And often we do see that a person shot by police are shot multiple times and have no chance of surviving before they bleed out. And indeed, the cops will hold them on the ground to make sure they bleed out. This is a shocking set of allegations for a lot of people. Maybe you've been watching TV and you think cops are thus and so, and probably you think that the good cops are the bad cops, is the way we are trained in cop show after cop show on the television and in the movies. This is not reality. The reality is we have invited a quasi-military force to permanently intimidate us into conformity. That's what we're dealing with right now. You've been listening to Press Watch on KBOO Portland. It's right up a couple minutes from the top of the hour. Coming up, you will hear more of the KBOO radio zine, so I hope that you will stay tuned. You can hear this podcast on podcast servers. Just go to any search engine that you prefer and put in KBOO Press Watch podcast, and you'll find a list to select from. Apple Podcasts is one of them. And we are also on the KBOO.fm server. That's kind of fun to navigate. Just pull it up, hit audio and schedule, and you'll find Press Watch on Thursday mornings, or you can use the search bar, which is about halfway down the page if you scroll down, to put in Press Watch, and you can find it that way and hear this anytime that you like. So we are broadcasting to you from our great big red and white Eiffel Tower on the hill at 90.7 FM, going out to Cascadia at 90.7 and other frequencies, and going out to you via KBOO.FM to all the ships at sea.
This is KBOO Portland. The time is 9:59. Coming up at 11, it's Between the Covers, where host David Naiman will be discussing the Book of Lost Saints, an evocative multi-generational Cuban-American family story of revolution, loss, and family bonds with New York Times bestselling author Daniel Jose Older. And at 11:30, it's Words and Pictures, conversations with pioneering animators and comic artists. KBOO is an independent, member-supported, non-commercial, volunteer-powered community radio station, and by making a donation through GiveGuide on kboo.fm/give, you're eligible for over $4,000 of free and discounted products from your favorite Portland brands. If you'd like to become a member, go to kboo.fm or use our mobile app and click on Donate.
KBOO is having our annual book and record sale Saturday, December 21st from 12 to 10 p.m. There's a special member-only preview hour from 11 a.m. to 12 p.m. The sale will be located at Jupiter Next in the Arium Ballroom at 900 East Burnside Street. KBOO is currently accepting donations of used and good condition books, records, CDs, and cassette tapes. KBOO is hosting sorting parties for this event on Friday, December 6th and Friday, December 13th at 5 to 7 p.m. at KBOO's 20 Southeast 8th Avenue. If you're able to help with sorting or help on the day of the sale, please contact volunteer at kboo.org. We hope to see y'all there.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Abortion Basics.